Your attention, please, for a moment for the important announcement, which is that we are best off if you turn your mobile phones off. I intend to break that on my own words on that point because I forgot to bring my watch, so to make sure that you leave here at a proper time to get back to work, I'll have to keep my phone live. And if it rings, I promise you I'll press the cancel button immediately, but that's the way it works. On other speakers, first of all, whom we have coming up for the very soon, we've got a double header on where is the journalism industry going to. First on would be David Schlesinger, the editor-in-chief of Reuters News, at lunch on October the 15th, with the title, News in the Digital World, Whither Journalism and Journalists. Whether journalism, I don't know. Whether journalists, to the poorhouse. That's an easy answer. And then on the 27th, Jeremy O'Grady, of the editor-in-chief of The Week in London, on making of news and views in the 21st century. And I've been told that he's a very good speaker and that this is going to be a really worthwhile event to attend. So I bring those two to your attention. I think those are some very good ones to come up. And as to what we will have today, well, let me say first of all that I myself was in the investment industry for many years, starting here in 1990 as a securities analyst and having to write securities research. So I can introduce a few things about how the business was in those days, even to our speaker today. And how the business was in those days, to start off, I was told on my first day that we do not at our firm, I shall not name it, have three recommendations. We have three recommendations, but they are not buy, sell, and hold. They are buy, buy on weakness, and long-term buy. And I broke that, I do remember once, when we had our London office calling up, it was in the middle of the bear market, the 82 bear market, and saying, Jake, here's a list of 100 companies. I want you to mark them A, fine, B, a bit troubled, C, going bust. So I promptly put a C behind six names, sent the telex, it was only telexes then, back to London. London promptly told a few of the clients that our research firm, our research analyst identified C for six companies going into trouble. The clients then went back to other brokers, the other brokers went back to the companies concerned, and when I came into the office next morning, my job was hanging by a slender fingernail. And the boss, Fung King Hei, if anyone ever remembers him, called me up on the carpet, and God bless him, said to me, you will apologize to those six, but not because you said they were going bust, but because you were played with dynamite in saying so. If, however, you think that they really are in danger of going bust, we shall not ask you to retract. What a gentleman. So as I say, the rule back in those days on writing securities research was, do not commit yourself to anything. It could go up, it could go down, it could go round and round. But I think Jeremy probably has a few lessons other than those ones alone. And has been in the business as a supervisory research analyst, a supervisory analyst for some time, getting hold of analysts' copy and not making sure that there's not too many split infinitives. Analysts have a way of introducing split infinitives into their copy. Making sure also, I hope, that their totals add up on any table they present. Analysts, again, have a way of presenting tables that if you add them up, they don't. But most of all, making sure they don't get in trouble, that they do things the proper way, which I'm told these days doesn't mean any longer that you must not make any commitment. Jeremy, tell us all about it.
Thank you very much, Jake. And thank you all for coming. Well, since Jake's day, securities research analysts have received a lot of bad press over the past decade or so. Back in 2003 to 2006, certainly in the US, the big global investment houses were hauled over the coals and were fined huge amounts of money. Well, not so much huge amounts of money in the scheme of their balance sheets, but $1.4 billion for the first 10 of those firms. There were a few more firms following that had to cough up as well. But they determined that they would be changing their way that they do business. And then More recently, a lot of the analysts would have been vilified for being slow in anticipating the global financial crisis and in not anticipating the risks associated with that crisis. And then again, when the market bounced back up again after the financial crisis, maybe a lot of analysts would have been vilified for being slow and being behind the curve in terms of reacting or proactively anticipating that. Well, I'm not here to defend analysts, and I know Jake isn't either, and I'm not here to defend regulators. What I have been doing over the last 18 years or so is I've been reading a lot of research, so I've been looking at it from the reader's point of view, from the client's point of view, and from perhaps a lot of your point of view as well. I suppose the best way to describe my role is like an art critic or like a food critic. I may not be able to bake the cake myself, but I know when the cake tastes nice and I know when it's not. So that's the way I look at my role. But before we go on any further, let's look at the next page, which is, just in case there are any regulators amongst us here, I thought I'd better give you some disclosures. So can you just take a moment to read those? But seriously, by way of disclosure, I would say that I'm not a regulator. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not even an analyst, really. I'm a supervisory analyst, which means I've been reading all this research. I haven't really been writing the research. So today, what we're going to do is look at two sides of the coin, or the same coin, really. We're going to look at the risks faced by analysts in writing their research, and we'll also look at the risks and issues faced by readers of that research. And readers are primarily the fund managers and the institutional investors. But for the purposes of us today, I'm going to look at it also from the perspective of reporters and journalists. I would say that the rules really apply to us all. None of us in this room really have true freedom of speech. We're all subject to defamation rules. We're all subject to copyrights. And there are market-wide laws that we have to abide by. We can't trade if we're trading in the markets. We can't trade on inside information. And I won't comment on to whether inside information should be legal or not. I'll leave that to Jake to comment in his column about the wherefores and whys of insider dealing. But as it stands, around the developed markets around the world, insider trading is illegal, and manipulating prices by, for example, spreading rumours, that's also legal in most markets. So we're all subject to these market-wide rules. We're also subject to sensitivities, cultural sensitivities, religious sensitivities, social sensitivities among the community we work in, and also the client base that we market our research to. So we really haven't got so-called freedom of speech, and none of us in this room have freedom of speech. There are some specific research requirements that a research analyst would have to abide by, and these requirements are not just for research analysts. These are for anyone who the regulator deems is writing research. Research is invariably defined by its content. So it doesn't really matter what you call yourself. You can call yourself a research analyst, you can call yourself a sales guy, a marketer, a fund manager, but if you're writing what a regulator deems to be research, then you have to go through the hoops of fire that I'm about to explain. And very small things I'd like to add on here that around the world the definitions may change slightly, but basically they boil down to two elements. There's the analysis, the in-depth analysis aspect, and also in the US it's sufficient information on which to base an investment decision. And in Hong Kong there are three items that you have, and you only have to satisfy one of those, and it's basically analysis, investment analysis. That may move the market, if you like. But providing a recommendation is not a prerequisite in itself. So you can imply a recommendation. All it is substantive analysis and information to either move the market or to prompt you to make an investment decision. And I would also add that you don't necessarily need to be paid for that advice. Research is, as I say, analysis and the market moving aspect of it. So you don't necessarily need to have to get paid for that advice, and that's fine. Can you all hear me? Yep. Okay. There we go. I usually wander up and down. Here we go. So let's. So if a regulator does determine that what you're writing is research, then what are the hoops of fire that a research analyst have to go through? Well, firstly, they'd need to be invariably around the world. They'd need to be registered or licensed in some respect to give their investment advice, to give their research. They'd invariably need to be subject to some continuing education requirements. They'd need to justify their views. I mean, this is common sense. No one would read an analyst who did not justify what they were saying. But importantly, they also have to highlight the risks to those investment views. They need to disclose any relationships or interests in the companies that they're writing about, whether the relationships are their relationships or their employer's relationships or interests in those companies. And in many parts of the world, you need to have your research approved by what's called a supervisory analyst. Certainly in the US, any research that gets distributed in the US would need to be approved by someone who's acceptable to the US regulatory authorities. I'm one of those people, supervisory analysts. I see another one in this room today, Louise. Hi. And also, you'd need to distribute your research fairly. And this is, I suppose, something that differentiates research analysts from independent financial advisors who tailor-make investment advice for their clients. Research analysts will come up with a research report and send it out to their client base. That's not to say that they can't do bespoke research, but that's a sort of complicated issue in itself, which we won't go into. Loads of cases from around the world where analysts have come a cropper. Just to look at a fair distribution, if you like, the two aspects there are selective distribution, where a research analyst or a research department or the investment bank selectively distributes that research to a few clients. Front running is a similar kind of offence, where the analyst himself might or herself might trade in the name. Following, you know, having done the research, might think, well, this is a cracking buy, so I'll go and buy the stock and then distribute my research. And that would also apply to the prop traders of the firm itself. Bank of America, for example, was fined $26 million only a couple of years ago for this kind of offense. In fact, it was $36 million because they were fined $10 million for dragging their feet in not providing information to the regulators. More locally, a Dow Hang analyst had his appeal quashed 3 or 4 years ago now, for front running, and he had his license suspended. In terms of conflicts of interest, I mentioned conflicts of interest at the beginning. This was the thrust or the main issue of the global analyst research settlements between 2003 and 2006. These are the settlements that were driven by Elliot Spitzer. You may remember him, and you may remember him for other reasons as well. Just to show that a lot of these banks haven't learned their lessons, Morgan Stanley was fined $800,000 US dollars only 2 months ago for more or less the same kind of disclosure infractions, if you like. But you know, I thought to myself, would you guys prefer the relevant cases, or would you prefer the most interesting cases? So what I thought I'd do is look at a couple of interesting cases, which may not be especially relevant to analysts, but you know, do affect them in some way. There was a securities analyst in the US 2 years ago who was fined $10,000 and suspended for 12 months for having various disclosure inadequacies, one of which was the fact that she was having a sexual relationship with a director of the company that she's writing about without disclosing that fact. I'd love to be in the compliance department working out a shagging disclosure for that one. Loads of bribery and gifts issues around the world. The one I like was Fidelity. Well, there's UBS analyst was jailed in Hong Kong a few years ago, you may remember, for accepting allegedly accepting $1 million bribe from a locally listed textile company. He got off. He appealed and got out early based on the evidence that put him away to start with was apparently unsound. But more interesting, I suppose, is Fidelity, who paid up coughed up $8 million recently for letting its investment fund managers receive lavish gifts and entertainment from the brokers and from analysts, etc. One of them involved a lavish party that was thrown for these guys, involving a dwarf tossing competition. No, Connie, that's when you throw the dwarf, okay? Can't work with me, guys. Loads of insider trading cases around the world. the ones interesting to us locally, Goldman Sachs analyst who was rapped on the knuckles by the SFC a few years ago, and also a Deutsche analyst who came back from a meeting with Ting Yi. But he went to trial, but that was it was found that he did have a reason for saying what he said. So it's a Goldman that was just a rap on the knuckles. Deutsche chap got off. So no actual case studies there. We've had the Morgan Stanley case study recently, but he wasn't an analyst as such. What I think are more interesting are these trading rings that have cropped up over the last few years. The big one at the moment in the US is Galleon, a hedge fund. And at least about 20 people have been indicted so far. Half of them have pleaded guilty. But the one I like was the two Goldman Sachs analysts and a Merrill Lynch analyst, going back 3 or 4 years ago. Well, they set up shop to trade on inside information. They put adverts in the paper to recruit people. They put they recruited people in a print shop who'd get a print of copy before it was released. They had an insider on a grand jury. And also, they hired lap dancers and pole dancers in the bars around Wall Street to glean as much information as possible from the bankers who would frequent those bars on a Friday evening about impending forthcoming M&A transactions. Loads of pillow talk cases around the world where husbands and wives have shared information, boyfriends and girlfriends have shared information. There was a Chinese couple in New Jersey who was they were sentenced to jail. And their defense was the fact that in their homeland, China, insider trading isn't treated as such a big deal. Well, I think that defense, A, wasn't accepted in the US, and B, that defense probably isn't true nowadays anyway, because the Chinese authorities have been clamping down on market manipulation and abuse. There's a lovely story that hit the FT about a CSFB salesman who was fined £20,000 by the FSA in the UK for basically phoning up a few of his clients and saying, "Psst, have I got some fantastic information for you about Boston Scientific?" And the clients listened to him, and in the end they didn't do anything about it because it was already known. It wasn't inside information. So the authorities couldn't get the guy on inside information, on insider dealing, because it wasn't inside information. So they fined him for misconduct, for pretending it was inside information. And the FT termed this outsider trading, which I think is a lovely concept. Loads of cases around the world on defamation, copyright, and all these cases are featured in the book. Only $390. So let's look at things from a regulator's perspective now. The focus of attention of regulators around the world is really on the securities professionals and professional investors. You know, every now and again they'll catch a dentist or a hairdresser or whatever, but really they're out to make sure that the market is being run fairly and operated fairly by the professionals. And they've got various tools at their disposal. For start, they've always got the benefit of hindsight to look back at any suspicious activity that may have been going on. Then and the level of technology has just been increasing leaps and bounds over the past few years. So they've got various technological skills at their disposal. They've also got access to email, phone records. The Morgan Stanley chap I referred to earlier, who was done for insider trading in Hong Kong, and apparently they could even check down the BlackBerry his BlackBerry scroll to see how far he'd read a message. In the US, in the Galleon case now, they've used wiretapping to catch their chap, Raj Rajaratnam. I'm assured that that doesn't happen in Hong Kong. They've also, in the US for many years now, been using plea bargaining and immunity from prosecution to help them with their cases. And that recently started in the UK as well. I'm not sure to what extent that would apply to Hong Kong. But these are various tools that regulators have around the world. And you can be sure that if these tools have proven to work in one jurisdiction or one location, then other locations may be quick to take those on. And there's so much more cross-border cooperation now than ever before, especially following the global financial crisis. And in fact, that Merrill Lynch, the two Goldman Sachs guys and Merrill Lynch who recruited the lap dancers, they were finally brought down because $1 million was suddenly deposited in a bank account of a little old retired seamstress in Croatia. And the local bank in the local town in Croatia alerted the Croatian bank authorities, who alerted the US authorities, and that's how the trail started. I'd also say that you know, if regulators do not have sufficient sufficient evidence to do a criminal case, they can always do a civil case. One story I like was Fox Pip Kelton, who recently bought out the Macquarie Bank, so they don't really exist anymore. But Fox Pip Kelton analyst was on an analyst briefing, going back a few years now, and there were other analysts from other firms on the same briefing. This was a company briefing. And in walked another Fox Pit Kelton analyst, and in walked another and a sales guy. And they heard some price-sensitive information being discussed at the meeting, so they went out and traded on the information. The regulators thought, well, it's going to be an argument. It's going to be a bit difficult to push for a criminal insider trading case, because one of the reasons would have been that the fact that there may have been enough analysts on the call to mean that information was being made public. So what they did in the end was Fox Pit Kelton did was settle with the regulators for not having sufficient supervisory processes and procedures in place to prevent insider trading. So I suppose the point I'm making is that, like a cop who catches you for speeding and you're saying you're not speeding, he'll say, well, you've got a broken light. So regulators will, if they're on your case, and you don't want them to be on your case, but if they are on your case, they'll try and catch you for something. I would say that regulators are not infallible. There's one lovely case which I always like to use, Jeffrey Putterman of Stevens Inc. He was, the NASD in the US reversed its opinion against him when, because he'd put a company in play. He'd said that, I think this company is going to be taken over. And of course, if you do that, if an analyst says, I think this company is going to be taken over, a regulator will presume one of two things. Either you've got some inside information, or you've got, you're trying to spread a rumor to push that price. But there is, of course, a third option, and that is that the research analyst in question might have actually come up with some good research. Shock, horror. Yeah. In the end, the company was taken over, and the regulators did concede that that Jeffrey Putterman had based his views on verifiable facts and reasonable assumptions, and there was no evidence to suggest that he had any inside information. So that's a lovely example there. So we've looked at it from the research analyst perspective. Let's just have a look at things now from the client's perspective, the reader's perspective, or in many of your cases here, the reporter's perspective. And from the reader's perspective, I boil it down into two parts again. One, to what extent do reporters perhaps run the risk of being regarded by a research analyst as a research analyst by regulators? And two, to what extent should they do readers and reporters and clients find value in research provided by these global investment banks? Firstly, I suppose I'd say that the media is generally outside regulators' purview. And there are specific exemptions and exceptions, not just in Hong Kong, but also in the US as well. But as I said earlier on, no one is outside the law. And there are various laws that everyone's got to adhere to, copyrights and defamation, and the market laws like insider trading and manipulating prices by spreading rumors. So no one is outside the law, but media is outside, generally speaking, the purview of regulators. They all have their own code of ethics to abide by. And indeed, the three main players in the media that may be relevant to our discussion today are the licensed commentators, people who have their own column or who have their own spot on the TV. One controversial figure in the US is Jim Cramer, who has his spot on CNBC. And for many years, Paul Pong would write his market moves in the South China Morning Post. Now, these guys happen to be licensed in their own right anyway. Jim Cramer was licensed as a director of TheStreet.com, and Paul Pong was licensed under his Chinese name as a fund manager with Pegasus Fund. So, so those guys are licensed anyway. They reveal their conflicts. They've got the experience, etc. So, again, they've got the platform, and they can say more or less what they want, subject to the research definitions, if you like. More commonly, a reporter or a journalist or an anchor lady or a woman or man or whatever would invite specialist expertise to experts to comment on a particular securities. And so these guys are, they're guests and they're licensed. They happen to be licensed. Every time I've been switching on CNBC over the last few days, I've seen Francis Lund of Fulbright Securities as a guest of Bernie Lowe. So Bernie Lowe gets his experts in to comment on the local Hong Kong market. I suppose what's of more worry to regulators is this the sea of unlicensed commentators, bloggers, Twitterers. You know, how are they going to regulate all those people? I don't know the answer to that, and this may come up on Friday's lunch talk when we hear from the Reuters chief editor about the future of journalism and the future of the media. But that's obviously a huge, great big task. For example, remember when there was a run on Bank of East Asia in Hong Kong? Apparently, that was all started from text messages, etc. How is one going to police that? Very difficult. There have been a couple of cases in Hong Kong, in China recently. Big Brother leader 777 was a self-styled patron saint of stock tipping, and he was jailed in China and fined for selling investment stock tips without a license. There was a director of Beijing Shoufang Investment Consulting who was accused of market manipulation, and he was reprimanded. And he had a license to talk on CCTV, and he had that license removed. So there is this sort of crossover between the world of research analysts and the world of stock picks and the world of the media. But more important, I suppose, more of greater interest to you guys here and to a lot of people is how relevant is research to the reader? How important it is? What should you look out for? So I think a good starting point is an email that was leaked to the FT back in 2006 by the global head of research for our very own HSBC. In it, he said, your research is worthless, and this was to the analysts internally at HSBC, and it was leaked to the FT. Your research is worthless, and you don't deserve to be paid this year. That caused a big controversy, and it caused a big debate in the FT. A lot of people wrote in, expressing their views, pro and con, that email debate. And one of the chaps wrote in and says, well, I monitor securities analysts' stock picks and their forecasts, and I think 50% of analysts are worthless and do not provide value. Well, that's fair enough, but I suppose the other side of the coin to that is that maybe 50% of analysts do provide value. So it's up to all of us to try and find out who provides value and to listen to what they say. As in any industry, you've got good guys, you've got bad guys, you've got honest analysts, you've got dishonest analysts, and you've got good and honest and bad and dishonest sales guys and marketers who'll be promoting that research. So you've got to sift through these guys and get to trust who you trust. But there are also surveys. There are also subjective surveys that you can read to see who have been voted the best analysts by the clients themselves. And these are subjective beauty polls, if you like. And they're run by Institutional Investor and in Asia, Asia Money. But these can be open to abuse as well. There was an instance back in 2005 when CLSA withdrew from the Asia Money poll because of allegations that they were trying to rig the poll. There are also objective polls run by StarMine and Bloomberg, and these are obviously are as good as the data that's collected. But again, they provide a more objective analysis of who's providing the good stock picks and the forecasts that turn out to be true. But ultimately, you've got to get down and read the research if you're going to decide if a research analyst is good for you. So, I've spent 18 years reading this research, and I can't tell you the number of times I've had a draft research report from an analyst that just regurgitates the news and concludes that the rating is a neutral or a hold. And I was interested to see at the back of the FT this weekend that the level of hold ratings around the world now is at its all-time high. And I've also seen research coming back from analysts that just rely on what the company tells them. They haven't done any cross-channel checks. They haven't checked with competitors and suppliers and customers. They haven't sort of tried to get an overall picture of this so-called mosaic theory of using, of course, publicly available information. But they've just relied on one source, and they've just been spoon-fed by the company. I would say that the media inevitably gets the research after bit of time delay, these investment banks will fairly distribute, or should fairly distribute, their research to their clients. And some of these clients may leak reports to you, but often the case that the company itself, for their own self-marketing purposes or LPR purposes, will forward a research report to you, but that may be 2 hours later, 2 days later, 2 weeks later, depending on the case. No big deal in the case of fundamental research that may have a year's time horizon or 2 years time horizon, because a lot of these big investment houses take days or weeks anyway to build up positions, and takes days or weeks to wind down positions. So just because you may get it a few hours late or a few days late, all is not lost. But ultimately, you've got to find out, are these guys adding value? Are they providing what you want? And are they independent? So just coming up to the last couple of slides now. I know I'm talking quickly, but I'm conscious of the clock. So you've got to work out, are these guys conflicted? Now, I didn't see too many of you read my disclosures at the beginning of this presentation. So, and presumably, and a lot of us just don't read disclosures in research reports. But obviously, the regulators have got to make sure that these disclosures are there for anyone who wants to read them. And as I mentioned earlier on, Morgan Stanley has been, keeps on getting in trouble with the regulators on that front. Back in the global, in the dot-com era, Jack Grubman of Citigroup, or Solomon Smith Barney before that, was accused of having too close a relationship with the companies he was writing about. He'd actually end up telling them what to do rather than hearing back what the companies, what they were going to do. On the other side, at the other end of the perspective, you have someone like a banks analyst at Morgan Stanley, who was barred from an OCBC analyst call in Singapore. And this was reported by the FT, and there was an inference, I suppose, that he'd never had a buy rating on the company, that was one of the possible reasons why he'd been barred from the from these meetings. But of course, clients may well trust that guy more than someone who's always kowtowing to the company management and always having a buy rating on that company. So you've got to judge for yourself whether this guy is independent or not. There are lots of little clues in the content of the research that I would draw your attention to. Firstly, from a common sense point of view, as I mentioned, has he got a reasonable basis for what he's saying? Are his arguments rational, reasonable, fair? Is he substantiating his views? And if he's saying he's changed his target price, is he trying to pull the wool over your eyes or misleading you in any way? Or is he really being clear into why he's changing the target price? What element of his target price is he changing? Is it because he's changing his forecast? Is it because he's rolling forward his forecast years? Or is it because he's, he's, for example, changing an input into DCF calculation or changing a PE rating because of a perceived change in risk? The analyst owes it to you to drill down into exactly why, what element of his valuation he's changing, rather than just fobbing you off with, it's all going well, therefore we're upgrading our target price. And also, is he consistent with his views? Is his target price and his buy recommendation or sell recommendation consistent? Or is he got a buy recommendation with a target price that's already lower than the current price? You've got to look at how consistent the analyst is being. And clarity of meaning. We heard Jake earlier on talk about buy on weakness being one of his pseudo recommendations. Well, that's exactly what it is. It's a pseudo recommendation. It doesn't help the reader in determining what is the recommendation at today's price. What do I do with this stock now? Because you don't know. The stock may never weaken. So and how much does that stock have to be weakened by before you start buying? So. The analyst can always say that in the text, but he's got to be very clear what his actual rating is at the current, at the latest price. And selective missing information. If an analyst tells you how good he is at stock picking, and he shows all his good recent stock calls, that's only half the story. The other half of the story is, can he please tell you the bad calls he's made? One easy catch, I suppose, from a supervisory analyst perspective, in terms of missing information, is, for example, a comparative valuation table. He says we should buy this stock because it's undervalued compared to these other stocks in the peer group. And if the analyst has, for example, accidentally missed out a major player in that group, a Sony or a Samsung or whatever, alarm bells have got to ring. Why is he not showing that company? Is it because that valuation doesn't quite fit with his argument? We mentioned earlier on about the blind acceptance of an issuer statement. I suppose one classic example would be the analyst goes along to the meeting, looks down, and the corporate guy, the PR, the IR guy says, right, well, ignore the net profit line this year, because what we're going to look at is this line here, because this is more important this year because of certain exceptional items or extraordinary items or whatever. The analyst himself has got to determine for himself and for his clients whether that is really a more appropriate line to look at. So, you know, again, don't let them pull the wool over your eyes by, you know, sometimes they do it on purpose, but often they just do it because they're junior or they're inexperienced and they just get spoon-fed from these companies. I suppose the most important thing about whether you're being treated well by a research analyst is to what extent they are highlighting the investment risks to their views. And this is, of course, what was a main problem with the financial crisis and the dot-com crisis before that. Invariably, any crisis, because when there's a bubble, you know, everyone's getting on the bandwagon and the analysts get too excited and they forget to come up with their reasonable basis and their investment risks. So just this last slide now. So is the analyst highlighting investment risks? And I would say that the higher the target price, the more the analyst owes it to you to warn you of the investment risks. It helps the analyst as well, because he can never really be proven totally wrong than if the case goes against him. And also, is he asking the company at the company meetings what items in the accounts are most open to interpretation, or where there's been most disagreement between the board and the auditor? You know, these are kind of questions that an analyst should be asking the company, and these are questions that you as a reporters could be asking the companies and the analysts as well. And if they're looking at a lawsuit in one particular company, to what extent has the analyst analysed the potential repercussions and risks of those lawsuits recurring around the world? But ultimately, one important element of risk, which has been overlooked in bull markets in bull times, but probably has become more important over the last couple of years, during the bear market and especially during volatile times, is, you know, it's not just about analysing numbers, it's also about assessing people too. And this gets us into a whole new world of corporate governance, well, not a new world, but a different world of corporate governance. Is the company trying to pull the wool over your eyes? If the old adage, falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus, springs to my mind, that if you can catch out the company lying in one aspect and disadvantaging one set of its stakeholders, whether that's customers, employees, creditors, minority interests, then you can presume that they're bullshitting to all of us. So, and for example, Vivendi, that example at the end there, you know, it's difficult for an analyst to say that a company is lying, but very often they are. And Vivendi was a few months ago now, a judge in the US accepted class certification for a class action suit against Vivendi on 52 counts of bullshit, basically. I'll end now. I've got one comment right at the end here, which is a comment that a certain Keith Hall of China Daily wrote about the first edition of my book. And it was the first line he wrote in this review, and I thought it was a lovely line, and here it is for you. This book almost makes the reader feel sorry for securities analysts. Well, you know, I hope after my talk today that you'll realize that they do have some hoops of fire to go through. And I hope after the talk today that you'll appreciate some of the issues that you might have to look out for as well. And with that, I'll sit down and take any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy. But I have to tell you that the best piece of analytical writing I saw there, that excerpt up front in the original Latin of what I take to have been Julius Caesar's De Bello Gallico. Pity he didn't have any inside information about forthcoming events at the Ides of March. His career might have been longer.
Very good. Well, I thought I'd fox the regulators with some Latin, but anyway, any questions?
Questions.
I'm sure I planted a few questions,
one,
didn't I?
Right over there. I'll go
first. Come.
There's your microphone.
In your book, you point out this trend, at least on the credit side, of credit desks putting out desk analysts and analysis versus formal analysis, and they're using that to kind of get around some regulations. Is there any validity to that, and what actually distinguishes desk analysis versus formal analysis?
Well, that's a very good point. They basically switched over from being analysts to sales, is the long and short of it. So that they were free, you know, they were free from the restrictions of having to go through all the hoops of fire, and they could sort of answer on a one-to-one basis any client calls that they had about that particular stock. So they, is there any validity? Unfortunately, the example that hit the papers of a company doing this was Lehman Brothers. So I don't know to what extent, you know, a regulator would have let them carry on doing that after, going forward. We'll never know. But I think that the long and short of it is basically getting analysts to move over to sales, so that they could think more on their feet in terms of answering questions, rather than having to stick to the line of their research report. But that's not to say that they could then issue their own research, because then they'd become research analysts again. It's just getting, I suppose, specialist sales is what you have a lot of in the UK and in Europe, not so much in Asia. It may not answer your question, but it's I think it's the long and short of it is you're moving from research to sales.
Looking at the difference between Jake's day and Jeremy's day at work here, there doesn't actually seem, apart from regulation, to be an awful lot of difference. Do you think with all the resources at their disposal, analysts are picking better stocks?
Well, as that FT article suggested, most people are sitting on the fence and just picking their holes. And I think a lot of analysts have been scared off, and after the financial crisis, a lot of people may have lost their jobs, so there may be more and more junior analysts. But are they better at picking stocks? Ultimately, I suppose the best ones are still as good as ever at picking stocks. And it's those guys that you need to find out, really. You need to sort of cut through all the chaff and try and identify the ones who are good. And there are plenty of them around. You've got to find out, are they just not just good, but honest as well?
My view was always that the most consistent analysts are the ones who got it consistently wrong. They are much more reliable than the ones who got it consistently right.
Then you know which way to trade, exactly.
If the whole purpose of research is to support trading or generate other revenue for the banks, what is the real role of a research analyst, really?
What is the real role? Yeah. Well, that was the whole crux of the Elliott Spitzer-driven conflicts of interest. And Dick Grasso at the time said there's a clear dividing line between bankers and analysts. So the analyst, their number one client is the client, it's not the company. And that's the new world that these... Well, it was always the world that they should have lived by, but now it's being more rigorously enforced. So, the role... it has changed in practice, but in theory it hasn't really changed. They should all have been, always have been, acting in the best interests of the clients. And let's face it, from a corporate governance point of view, that is where long-term business growth is going to come from. It's the clients. They've got to keep their clients happy. And the more independent they can be seen to be, the more readers and clients they're going to get. So I suppose that's always been the theoretical role, and every now and again the regulators pounce on them and make sure that they're back in line.
Just want to know, it's so difficult to actually choose the right analyst. Is there any scientific or more systematic way of evaluation so that you can actually track, their recommendations, what they said, and whether it's work or not, so that, people get... want to read a certain research report can say, yeah, I know, this guy has been pretty good in the past.
Well, at the back of each research report, they should be showing their recommendation performance, but there also there are these Starminds and Bloombergs who track their performance as well overall. But the back of, you can always ask the company for that information, and they should always provide it for you. And that's one thing that I suppose I didn't make clear, is, these guys, we'll have minimum periods of time that they've got to look back over to see how performance measures up, but they can be quite. They can pick times that are more convenient to them. to show you how these performs. So you've got to keep your eyes open and to try and make sure that you know, they're doing everything on a like-to-like basis, that they're comparing all the stocks on a like-to-like basis, not just cherry-picking, not just the good ones, but cherry-picking the time frame that they want to show you as well. So you know, that's I suppose, but always ask them, you know, and if they don't give you your answer, then go somewhere else.
Jem, I guess my question is, as you probably know, the SFC here in Hong Kong, our esteemed watchdog, has just chucked out to market for consultation a new paper dealing with pre-deal research.
Right.
What are your views on that? Is it necessary for the market? A total waste of time, or you just couldn't care less?
Well, a very good question, and obviously a very searching question. Pre-deal research is a separate entity in its own right, but ultimately it is research, and ultimately I suppose the SFC, can only be doing the right thing by seeking for more transparency. So it's very difficult to argue against more transparency. But I would say that having worked in that in the investment banking environment for the past 18 years or so, the pre-deal research reports themselves are the most thoroughly checked reports, and they're the only genre report, if you like, that goes out to outside counsel, that goes out to lawyers to be vetted and checked to make sure that that the analyst is not saying that anything that's going to be inconsistent with the eventual prospectus, and is not and it's very, very clear that the analyst is associated with a company that's involved in the deal. So your question about it, is it over the top? Well, it may be, but I think it's difficult to argue against greater transparency. That's maybe a little bit fluffy, but
well, I'll have to pin you down that one, Jeremy, because one of the big problems with pre-deal research is it doesn't have a price. They're waiting until the price is finally fixed.
Right.
How can you decide whether it's a good buy or a bad buy when the price can vary 30% either way?
And it's not designed to do that. It's actually designed to to look at the company, to look at its business. It's not designed to drill down to the... here you go. I knew this would happen with Jake. It's not. It's designed to be company focused, business focused, not securities focused. It's not meant to steer you into actually buying or selling that. It's just to give more information an analysis that may otherwise not be available. And certainly in the US, that information would not be available. So it's something for the market, but no, it doesn't drill down into the securities itself, and it doesn't go that far. And it's not intended to.
Hello. I just was wondering, given that there's this whole new superstructure put over Wall Street in the research area, do you think that actually adds value?
I suppose you could say that about any industry. To what extent should we live in an anarchic world as opposed to a regulated world? Their aims are reasonable in terms of getting a fair market, a reasonable level playing field where information is fair and people are treated fairly. So you can understand the underlying principles. But I still think that the good research analysts can still provide good research. Don't forget, this is all, if you're an honest guy and you're good at what you do, all this doesn't really matter because you're already coming up with your reasonable view. You're already highlighting risks to your investment case. You're being open, you're being transparent. So I think it does help at the negative end of quashing out all the negative aspect of research. And I don't think it should really affect the positive end, where analysts are, the good analysts and the honest analysts just get on with doing their stuff. It's, as I say in my book, actually, that the regulatory mine, it's called a minefield by a lot of people. But if you're honest and if you're good, that shouldn't matter because you can just ignore it and you just carry on doing things honestly. It's like a car salesman. The car salesman who answers your question about what's happening under the bonnet, about the engine, doesn't really have any anything to worry about. The person who has something to worry about is the guy who tries to sell you on how pretty the car looks and you know, tries to make you ignore about what's going on in the engine. Is that a nice fluffy answer? Enough of it safe.
Before lunch, we were talking about IKEA, and I was preparing a really incisive and in-depth question. But for the rest of the lunch, all I could think about was that seamstress in Croatia. What more can you tell us about her?
I think she was related to one of the guys, which is why she had $1 million suddenly parked in her account. And I can't remember whether it was $1 million because that was $1 million being parked there, or whether they wanted her to use that $1 million to buy shares. But no, there was a relationship aspect. In fact, those two Goldman Sachs analysts and the Merrill Lynch analysts were part of a much broader team. There were Germans involved, Croatians involved, and Americans involved. And the thing about insider trading rings is that if you can catch one person, or you know, the more trades they do, the more people involved, the riskier it obviously gets, because all you need to do is catch one person, and they'll spill the beans on and everyone else to get a lighter sentence.
Do you think the role of another research firm will increase over time, or?
That's a very good question. I'd throw that open to the room, really, because certainly they, it was mandated that these big global investment banks had to buy that investment research from independent research houses, and certainly there'll always be a role for independent research. How do they get paid? That's obviously another question altogether, and. But you know, there's always going to be room for someone who can analyze a situation, can look at an M&A situation, and can come up with a good argument, whether they're in an investment bank or a research house. It's just that the investment banks, you obviously have a bit more money to play with. The independent research houses, I think, there will always be a role for them, but to what extent they can live the same lavish lifestyles. And I don't know, but any comments on that, any views on that? Independent research houses. I saw an interesting.
There's no money in it.
Sorry.
I have a comment on that. I'm not sure how many people here are familiar with XBRL.
Yeah, extensible
but
business
it's
reporting.
It's all the financial statements that are being issued, at least starting in the U.S., but it's going to be happening globally.
Yeah.
Are going to be submitted in a format that will make it very easy for anybody just to suck it up and put it in their spreadsheets. Because you talked about investment banks and how, you know, they've got the capital to provide, you know, the support for analysts. I think that XBRL is just going to democratize fundamental research. You're seeing all these people out there on the blogosphere or whatever that are going to have the same tools available to them that investment bank analysts take for granted right now. So I think 5 years out from now, anybody's going to be able to just tap. They're not going to need a $2,000 a month subscription to Bloomberg. Everybody will have it.
And in fact, there are programs available. You tap that in and a research report is automatically generated without any kind of value-added subjective comment. And of course, clients will ultimately want that value added. But yes, I mean, the world's going to be awash with research, and what are the regulators going to do about it? I don't know.
And the price will move, and the questions will remain the same. You don't, after the market says it's good, after the market says it's bad. It won't get you any further along. It just refines the question in the end. Any more questions here? Because we're reaching about, I think it should be the end of this afternoon. Some of you are wanting to go back to work at 2 o'clock. So I'll give time for one question more. 3, 2, 1.
There's always one.
Just wondering, Jeremy, which analysts do you pay the most attention to?
I don't want to be biased here, because in fact I pay attention to my own method of stock picking, which doesn't involve reading analysts. But no, over the years one person who's made a great impression on me from my earlier days in Morgan Stanley was Peter Churchhouse, who many of you will know, because he told a story, and I think a lot of analysts just crunch the numbers and come up with some some automatic statements here and there, but Peter would engage the reader, and I really enjoyed reading it. But he's stopped being a research analyst for many years now.
And before you go, Jeremy, the T-shirt.
Thank you very much, Jake. Thank you all for coming. It's not a wave of my bar bill, is it?
Jeremy's book is on sale on a table there, and the author has kindly offered to stay here and sign copies that you buy.
Can do. Yep.
Do you stay if you want Jeremy to sign? Buy them. Take a seat there, and if anyone comes up.